The boulder toppled off the edge of the bluff and fell 20 feet or so to the slope. Bo didn't pay any attention to the rock slide he had caused. Swiftly now, he centered the Winchester sights on the surprised man who suddenly was exposed as he knelt there where the boulder had been. His aim was as deadly as ever. The slugs ripped through the ambusher's body. He jerked to his feet, lurched to one side, and dropped his rifle as he clapped his hands to his bullet-riddled torso. Woo-ha! Scratch must have seen the man on the bluff fall. The attackers must have seen that too, and now that their quarry was no longer pinned down, the odds appeared to have shifted. Bo swung around. He still had some shots left in his rifle, so he started spraying the trees where the men were hidden. That turned the tables even more. When Bo ceased fire, he heard pounding hoofbeats. They were headed west, paralleling the trail, but keeping the screen of trees between them and the lawmen.
Hold your fire, they're lighting out!
You all right up there, Bo?
Yeah, I'm fine. How about you fellas?
A couple of nicks, nothing to speak of.
Brubaker emerged from the trees, carrying his rifle.
Blast it, we gotta get after that wagon. Creel, where's your horse?
Hold on!
Bo slid down the rock to the ground. He cast a regretful look at Duck Forbes' corpse, then caught his horse's dangling reins and swung up into the saddle. Duck's mount still stood there too, so Bo led it out of the rocks and handed the reins to the eager Brubaker.
What happened to the fellow who was riding this animal?
He was the first one hit. He didn't make it.
Duck Forbes, right? Damn it, I like that boy. What little I knew of him. Come on!
He galloped along the trail with Bo close behind him. They raced past the bluff where the ambusher had lurked, then rounded a couple of bends before abruptly reining to a halt. The wagon was stopped as the team cropped grass at the side of the trail. As Bo had expected, the horses had run for a short distance and then forgotten to be scared anymore. All of them appeared to be unharmed, including Brubaker's saddle mount that was still tied to the back of the vehicle.
Well, it didn't wreck anyway. That's something to be thankful for. Be careful, Creel.
Bo could see that the door at the rear of the wagon was still fastened with the big padlock.
They can't have gone anywhere.
Nah, I reckon not, but I still don't trust them.
Bo didn't either, but he didn't see any way the prisoners could have gotten free. He drew his Colt too as he approached the wagon alongside Brubaker.
Hey in there! Sing out and let me know if you're all right!
You don't care whether we're all right! You want us all dead!
I want you to hang after a legal trial! There's a big difference!
Not to us, you no good stinking son of a gun!
Well, she sounds like she's all right anyway.
Brubaker dismounted and approached the wagon.
I want to know if Lo and Elam are all right too!
You damn near got us killed!
Who was doing all that shooting? Couldn't have been Hank and the rest of the boys.
Brubaker gave Bo a nod, indicating that he was satisfied all three prisoners were alive. He didn't answer Lowe's question. Instead, he handed the reins of Duck's horse to Bo.
You can lead this one back to the others.
He holstered his Colt and climbed to the driver's seat to swing the wagon around. That wasn't an easy job in the narrow trail, but Brubaker managed. Bo led the extra horse, and Brubaker followed with the wagon. By the time they reached the scene of the ambush, Scratch and the Cherokee Light Horsemen had emerged from the trees. Some of the men had fetched Duck's body from the rocks. It was laid out now at the side of the trail. The young man's face was oddly peaceful.
That had to be Nat Kinlock and his bunch who jumped us. Stinking murderers.
You told us Kinlock has relatives in this area, so you must have a pretty good idea where to find him.
That's right. And he knows it, too. That's why he set this trap for us. He figured he had to stop us. But if we move fast enough, we might be able to corner him and the others at his grandfather's farm.
And mount up and go on.
We have to bury Duck.
We'll take care of that. Then we'll catch up with you fellas and see if we can give you a hand.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Wait just a chicken scratch a minute. We got our own job to do. Oh, I reckon we could take time to lay this poor young fellow to rest. But after that,
Where's this farm you mentioned?
About 5 miles west of here. In a valley between a couple of ridges that run east and west, Massasauga Valley, the one I mentioned earlier. 42 knows where it is.
Pretty much the way we was already going, sounds like.
Now listen here.
Marshal, we promised to help you deliver those prisoners, and we will. But giving Charlie and Walt and Joe a hand isn't going to delay us very much, especially since we're already headed in that direction.
We're wasting time. We're much obliged to you for taking care of Duck, but we've got to be riding. Come after us or don't. It's up to you.
With that, he and his men swung up into their saddles and galloped off along the trail. They paused at the foot of the bluff long enough to take a look at the man Bo had shot.
It's one of Kinlock's men, all right.
All right. There's a shovel and the possum belly under the wagon. Let's get that grave dug.
You gonna help Charlie and those other fellas?
Might as well. I'm a lawman too, and I hate murdering outlaws worse than anything. Just don't let Judge Barker hear about this.
No need to say anything to the judge. Anyway, this job's not really official.
Nope. It's personal now.
The Texans found a suitable spot not far from the trail and took turns digging the grave, while Brubaker wrapped Duck's body in a blanket. After they had lowered the young lawman into the ground and covered up the grave, they stood beside the mound of freshly turned dirt with their hats in their hands.
I've had to bury quite a few fellas who got cut down for their time, so, unless one of you wants to say a few words,
Go ahead.
Lord, we ask you that you show your infinite mercy to this young man who was foully murdered by owl hoots. His name was Duck Forbes, or at least that's the only name we know him by. I reckon you know all there is to know about him. He should still be here with his friends and family, but since he ain't, please forgive him any sins he might have done and accept him into your kingdom with your blessings. Amen.
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 All right, let's go get the skunks that done this.
Charlie, Walt, and Joe may have taken care of them by the time we catch up.
Well, if they have, then we can help the burying there, too.
Brubaker climbed onto the wagon seat while Bo and Scratch mounted up. All of them moved off along the trail at a rapid clip, with the Texans leading the way. They couldn't afford to forget about the continuing threats from Hank Gentry's gang and the rest of the Staley clan. Because of that, he and Scratch kept their eyes open, scanning the countryside in front of them and to the sides, as well as checking their back trail frequently. The ambush had taken place at mid-morning. The sun was almost directly overhead by the time Bo and Scratch heard the distant pop of gunshots ahead of them.
Sounds like Charlie and his pards opened the ball without us.
I ain't surprised. They were raring to settle a score with that bunch.
Does this trail go through that valley where Kinlock's grandfather has his farm?
It does, so we shouldn't have any trouble finding the place.
After several minutes, the trail emerged into a broad valley that stretched out for probably 10 miles between two rugged ridges. The valley floor wasn't completely flat. Some knolls and brushy knobs were scattered across it. The shots guided Bo, Scratch, and Brubaker to one of those knobs. Three horses were tied at the bottom of the slope. Bo recognized them as the mounts the Cherokee Light Horseman had been riding.
Charlie and those other two fellas must be on top of this hill. I wonder what's on the other side.
Old man Kinlock's farm, I bet. Those outlaws are probably forded up inside the old man's cabin.
Let's go see.
Brubaker climbed down from the wagon seat and brought his Henry rifle with him. The Texans dismounted and tied their horses to saplings. The three men started climbing the slope, which was covered with brush and small trees. It was slow going, but a narrow game trail made the climb a little easier.
Charlie! Hey, Charlie, we're coming up behind you, so don't get trigger happy.
Come on up, 42. We can use a hand.
They finished the climb and sprawled on the ground at the knob's crest next to Grey Wolf. Walt Moon lay to one side and Joe Reeder to the other. Reeder had a bloody rag tied around his left thigh as a bandage.
I see one of your men got hit.
It's nothing. It won't slow me down none.
I reckon that's the old man's place.
Yeah. His name's George Kinlock. Honest as far as that goes, or at least so I've heard. But he lets Nat and the rest of the gang stay here. That puts him on the wrong side of the law as far as I'm concerned.
Me too. Looks like a pretty sturdy cabin.
Too sturdy. Nat and the others have holed up in there, and we're gonna have a devil of a time getting them out.
Bo studied the layout. On the other side of the creek, open fields ran into the distance, some of them with brush fences between them. A man might be able to creep closer to the cabin from that direction by using the fences for cover, but that wouldn't get him close enough. He would still have to cross the creek in the open, which would probably result in his painful introduction to a bullet. On this side of the creek, next to the cabin, was a lean-to shed that was crowded with horses at the moment. Grey Wolf and his partners might be able to shoot those horses, although the angle wasn't all that good, but they weren't the sort of men to kill helpless animals unless they had to. Farther off to one side stood a log barn with an attached corral on one side and a muddy hog pen on the other. Several massive hogs rooted happily in the mud, oblivious to the gunfire going on nearby.
There's too much open ground all around the place. If we could get close enough, we might be able to set the cabin on fire and smoke them out. But they're good shots. They'd pick off anybody who tried to do that.
How about shooting some flaming arrows down there?
We're Cherokee, not Comanche. Did you see any bows and arrows among our gear?
Oh, well, I didn't mean any offense.
Don't worry about it. Actually, I am a pretty good shot with a bow. The Walt there is even better. But we don't have any. I thought about trying to make some torches and throwing them down from here, but it's too far.
How deep are those creek banks?
I don't know. 5, maybe 6 feet from the look of them.
What if a man took some torches along with him, unlit, and waded along that creek? He could get closer that way, maybe close enough to light the torches and toss them onto the roof.
That might work. But there's a window on that side. If any of that bunch spotted him when he raised up to throw the torches, they could cut him down without much trouble.
I'm willing to run the risk.
And if I went with him, I could cover him in case they did see him.
You'd both get wet. That creek's spring-fed, runs year-round.
I reckon we could both do with a bath. What do you say, Bo?
That was my idea. I'm willing to do a little wading.
All right, we'll give it a try, but only because I don't see any other way to get them out of here. Let's find some branches and put together a few torches.
Bo picked out 3 suitable branches that were heavy enough he could throw them easily, but short enough that he could carry them under his coat if he needed to. Around one end of the branches, he wrapped strips cut from a wool blanket.
If they're gonna burn hot enough to set the roof on fire, we need to soak them in something. I don't suppose anybody's got kerosene.
Wait here.
Brubaker went back down the slope to the wagon and rummaged in the box under the driver's seat. When he returned, he brought with him not a bucket of kerosene, but rather a jug with a cork in its neck.
Why, 42, is that a jug of white lightning? I thought you marshals were supposed to track down the people who bring fire water into the Indian nations, not smuggle it in yourself.
I brung it along for medicinal purposes. You can ask the 2 Texans if they see me nipping at it.
We haven't.
We ain't been watching for it either.
Oh, that's enough. Take this with you, and when you get close enough to the cabin, pour some of it on the torches. They'll light easy and burn strong.
You're right about that. Ready, Scratch?
Yeah, sure. Let's get this done.
The sky had been mostly clear that morning, but clouds had moved in during the day, so that now the sky was partially overcast and the sun was hidden. That made the air seem even chillier. Bo told himself not to worry about that, as he and Scratch mounted up and rode about 1/2 mile north. The knob had shielded them, so the men in the cabin wouldn't have seen them depart. They angled west and came to the creek and dismounted.
Do we start wading here?
Nah, we'll leave the horses here and follow the stream on foot as far as we can before we climb down the bank. No point in getting any colder than we have to.
That sounds good to me. My circulation ain't what it used to be. Hey, remind me again why we didn't suggest that a couple of them young Indian lads do this.
Because we didn't think of it?
Yeah, that's what I was afraid you were going to say. Come on.
Bo carried the torches, while Scratch brought the jug of moonshine. The creek bank was choked with brush, which made their progress slow. They came in sight of the area that had been cleared along both sides of the stream for the Kinloch farm. Bo motioned toward the creek. He handed the torches to Scratch and climbed down the bank first. The drop-off was steep, but not sheer, so he didn't have much trouble. When he stepped down into the water, he sank to his knees, which put his head just below the top of the bank.
Not chilly, is it?
Just be glad we only have to wade in it, don't have to swim.
Scratch handed down the torches and the jug.
You reckon there's enough in here to spare, Swig? Might help warm us up.
Better not risk it.
Yeah, that's what I thought you'd say.
They started trudging along the creek. Bo was in the lead. He had just taken a step when suddenly his foot kept sinking through the water. Just as he had fallen into that ravine, he knew instantly that he had stepped into a hole in the creek bottom. The water didn't come all the way up over Bo's head, but when he stopped sinking, he was up to his neck in the creek. Scratch's free hand closed around Bo's wrist and hauled up.
Now, Bo, we gotta get out of here and get into some dry clothes.
Not yet. Close now.
It was true. The shots from the cabin sounded like they were only a few yards away. The Texans moved on a short distance, and then Scratch pulled himself a few inches up the bank.
I can see the roof.
They were back in knee-deep water now.
You'll have to light the torches. My matches are soaked.
Sure. Get them ready.
Bo held out one of the torches. Scratch used his teeth to pull the cork from the jug, then tipped it just enough to let the clear liquid inside soak into the blanket strips wrapped around the end of the branch. He got them thoroughly wet without spilling much of the whiskey. The stuff would evaporate quickly, so they didn't waste any time as they soaked all 3 torches. Then Scratch set the jug on a little shelf of earth that jutted out from the creek bank and dug a tin of matches from his shirt pocket. He snapped one of them to life with his thumbnail and held the little flame to each of the torches in turn. The whiskey-soaked rags caught fire immediately and blazed up.
Let's go!
They scrambled up the bank, carrying the burning torches. The cabin was about 20 feet away. The window in the wall facing them was a dark hole. Nobody was looking out. Bo drew back his right arm and let fly with that torch. Spun through the air and landed cleanly on the cabin's roof. Scratch's torch bounced and looked like it might fall off, but then it caught on the rough shakes and came to a stop. Bo's second torch landed close to it. All three continued to burn. But even though the wooden shakes on the roof quickly started to char and smolder, they didn't actually catch fire, and the flames on the torches were beginning to die down. They looked like they might burn out before they caught the roof on fire.
Well, now what?
Hand me the jug.
What are you... Oh, hell, that ought to do it all right, but you better let me heave it. We'll only get one try, and you're shaking to beat the damn band.
That's good.
Probably half full. Ought to be enough.
Let her rip!
The jug dropped, its weight carrying it down with enough force that when it struck the roof, it seemed to explode, spraying moonshine in all directions, including over the still-burning torches. With that added fuel, there was no question now that the cabin roof was going to catch on fire. It did so in a matter of seconds, as Bo and Scratch slid back down the creek bank and their feet splashed in the water.
I hope there were no women folk or kids in there with those outlaws.
Me too, but if there are, none of the fellas up on that knob will shoot them when they come out.
You're gonna freeze to death if we don't get you in some dry clothes soon.
I'll be all right. We better be ready in case any of them come this way when they run.
Scratch slid his Remingtons from leather.
You're right about that. With that window on this side, they're liable to.
The shooting continued as the lawmen peppered the burning cabin with slugs. Bo and Scratch waited tensely to see if any of the outlaws were going to flee in their direction. That window in the back wall of the cabin would be easy enough to climb out of. They didn't have to wait very long. A figure appeared, clambering and sliding down the bank about 15 feet from the spot where the Texans had drawn back and pressed themselves against the slope.
Damn it, Nat! You claimed they'd never chase us this far!
Shut up and run, Chester!
Both of them started to splash across the creek. Bo and Scratch stepped out with leveled guns.
Hold it right there, boys!
Neither of them really expected the fleeing outlaws to surrender, and Kinlock and Chester didn't disappoint. The two men twisted around and clawed guns from underneath their long coats. Bo and Scratch turned their heads to look in the cabin's direction and saw an old man in overalls leveling a double-barreled shotgun at them. Bo had time to realize the old-timer was probably George Kinlock, Nat's grandfather. He realized as well that he and Scratch had nowhere to take cover and they were about to be shredded by that double load of buckshot. The old man dropped the shotgun and fell to his knees. He pitched forward and slid headfirst down the bank, coming to a stop with his head just above the water as his overalls snagged on a protruding branch. There was a growing bloodstain in the middle of his back.
Huh, one of those fellows on the knob must have drilled him.
It saved our lives. I'll keep him covered just in case while you check the other two.
Scratch nodded and waded along the creek to check carefully and make sure that both Nat Kinlock and the fugitive called Chester were dead. When he was certain, he looked back and gave Bo a grim nod.
The old-timer is, too. It's a shame. If he really was mostly an honest man, like Charlie said.
An honest man don't let thieves and cold-blooded killers hide out with him, family or no family. And if he's just scared of his grandson, didn't have no choice in the matter, he would not have tried to blow us to hell and gone with a scattergun.
Creel! Martin! Are you down there?
Yeah! Is it safe to come up?
Come ahead! We've cleaned out the rest of this rat's nest!
The Texans holstered their guns. Scratch took hold of Bo's arm.
Let me give you a hand getting up that creek bank.
Gracias.
De nada.
Bo was about to pull away and tell his old friend that he could take care of himself, but then the shakes hit him again, and he was glad for the firm grip Scratch had on his arm. They climbed up the bank, and by the time they were back on level ground, Brubaker, Charlie Greywolf, Walt Moon, and Joe Reeder were gathered around the burning cabin. A couple of bodies were sprawled face down on the ground near the cabin. Those had to be the other members of Nat Kinlock's gang. The heat coming from the leaping flames felt wonderful to Bo. As long as he was standing within reach of it, that kept the bone-numbing cold at bay. In fact, his clothes were already starting to dry a little.
Are you two all right?
We will be, once we ain't half frozen. Our horses are about a half mile upstream. We got dry clothes in our war bags.
Walt, can you go fetch those horses?
Sure, Charlie. Be back in a few minutes.
Nat Kinlock and a man called Chester are in the creek. So was an old man who tried to use a shotgun on us. I'm guessing one of you hombres shot him?
That was 42 here.
And a heck of a shot it was, too.
Darn right it was. Saved our bacon for sure.
The old man was Kinlock's grandfather?
Yeah. If he had come out of there empty-handed and not threatened anybody, he'd still be alive. So I'm sorry for what happened to him, but he brought it on himself.
Most people do, one way or another.
Bo had warmed up considerably by the time Walt Moon got back with the Texans' horses, but it felt mighty good anyway to get out of those wet clothes and into dry duds. After pulling on fresh socks, both he and Scratch set their boots aside to dry.
The way those flames shot up so high, I'm thinking that was more than just the roof catching fire.
We sort of had to help it along.
I thought I saw a glimpse of my jug sailing through the air. I'm not getting it back, am I?
Oh, I'm afraid not, 42. But it went for a good cause.
I suppose so. When we get south of Red River, we'll pick up another one at some trading post. You know, for medicinal purposes, just in case.
Just in case.
Since it took all afternoon to bury the dead outlaws, it made sense to camp there on George Kenlock's farm that night, although they put some distance between themselves and the smoldering, stinking rubble of the cabin. By evening, Bo and Scratch had warmed up and were back to normal as they sat beside the campfire Charlie Greywolf had built.
I just hope you don't catch a grip. My ma always said that if you got wet and cold, you'd come down with it sure as shooting.
Your ma said a lot of things that weren't necessarily right.
Yeah, but she could cook a mighty fine apple pie.
Yeah, I have to give her credit for that. I could do with a hot slice of your ma's apple pie right now.
Well, so could I, Bo. So could I.
Walt Moon took over the cooking chores that night. The fry bread he made was delicious. Brubaker set aside a portion of the food for the prisoners, and when everyone else had finished eating, he unlocked the door at the back of the wagon.
Damn well about time you tended to us.
They was too busy powwowing with their redskin friends.
Kara was unusually quiet. She sat with her head down and her shoulders slumped.
I wouldn't advise trying anything. We spent the day killing outlaws and nobody's in a very good mood. Give us an excuse to do some more shooting and you might regret it.
Just give us something to eat. I'm just about starved in here. I'm a big man. I can't live on two little meals a day.
You won't starve to death. Not where you're headed.
After they had eaten, Brubaker unlocked their chains and took them out of the wagon one at a time.
My arms are getting mighty stiff from being pulled back like this all the time. Don't you think you could chain them in front of us for a while, Marshal?
Well, I suppose if I was going to do something like that, tonight would be the time to do it since we got three other lawmen here.
Indian lawmen? They ain't allowed to shoot white folk.
We'll make a special exception in your case. Happen you try to get too smart with us. As far as anybody will ever know, me or one of these temporary deputies would be the fellow who ventilated you. You got that, Low?
The big man lowered his shaggy head and didn't argue anymore. Brubaker took Kara out of the wagon.
Stand there and don't try anything. You boys keep her covered, understand?
Five guns were pointed at Kara while Brubaker unlocked the shackles holding her wrists behind her back. Brubaker slapped the shackles right back on her. She didn't seem to mind. She rolled her shoulders to ease the stiffness in those muscles.
What about the other two?
Fine, but in the morning, the hands go behind their back again.
I don't care. Right now, I'm just grateful for a little break.
The night passed peacefully. The overcast remained in place, and Brubaker studied the gray, leaden skies the next morning.
Looks like there might be some snow in those clouds.
I don't think so, 42. Been mighty dry down in these parts for months now. We haven't had any rain or snow to speak of in a long time. I hear it's even worse down in Texas, where you're headed.
It's always dry in Texas.
This is worse than usual. There's a real drought down there, and it's spreading north.
Well, it can hold off raining until after we get where we're going, as far as I'm concerned. This wagon's pretty heavy. I don't want it bogging down on muddy roads.
They got ready to move out.
I'd still like to go with you to the border, 42. Especially since you gave us a hand like that. But our orders were to deal with Kinlock, and then get back to Tahlequah as soon as we can. The light horse has a lot of ground to cover, and we're stretched pretty thin.
I know that. Don't worry about it, Charlie. Good luck to you.
And to you fellas as well.
Earlier, after breakfast, Brubaker had chained the prisoners' hands behind their backs again. Lo and Elam had complained bitterly about that, but Kara had taken it in stony silence. She seemed to have gotten tired of raising a ruckus about everything. There was a look of dull acceptance on her face, not only about the chains, but about her ultimate fate as well.
Keep your eyes open for Hank Gentry and his gang. I know they've got to be looking for these three. Gentry's liable to gun down anybody who gets in his way.
Don't worry, 42. If we run into them, they won't find out from us that we've seen you.
Never crossed my mind that they would.
Brubaker got the wagon rolling westward along the narrow trail again. Bo took the lead, and Scratch rode behind the vehicle to keep an eye on their back trail. Charlie Greywolf proved to be better at predicting the weather than Brubaker. The gray clouds hung stubbornly in the sky, but they didn't produce any snow or rain. The day passed uneventfully. Late that afternoon, the travelers came to a crossroads, although giving it that name was probably an overstatement. A dim, narrow trail running north and south intersected the westerly one they were on. Brubaker swung the wagon onto the southern trail.
We'll head south through the Red River. There's a crossing there above Gainesville. Once we're in Texas, we'll cut back east to Dallas and then Tyler. Be there in about a week, if the folks stop shooting at us and slowing us down.
The trail angled to the southwest. Brubaker followed it for a couple of miles and then called a halt for the day. After they had made camp and eaten supper, Brubaker opened the door of the wagon to feed the prisoners.
Are you gonna move our chains back to the front again?
Not hardly. We had those Cherokee Light horsemen with us last night to help out if any of you got rambunctious. Now things are back to the way they were before.
Sure was a lot more comfortable the other way.
It ain't my job to keep you comfortable. Just to get you to Tyler so Judge Southwick can deal with you as he sees fit.
Well, now listen, 42. We got us a pretty good routine down by now. I don't see that it'd hurt anything if we made things a mite easier on these folks.
Blasted don't get taken in by them, Morton. They never made it any easier on the innocent people they killed in their robberies, now did they?
Well, I reckon not. But it seems like it'd be less trouble for us, too. I mean, for one thing, we wouldn't have to feed them. They could do that themselves. And if we kept on covering them all the time the wagon's open, I don't see how they can get away.
What do you say, Creel?
Scratch is right. I don't see how chaining their hands in front of them is going to make any difference. It sure won't while they're riding and chained to the floor, too.
All right, we'll try for it in a day or two. But if anything happens, I'm holding you two responsible.
That's fine.
One by one, while the Texans covered them, Brubaker switched the chains on the prisoners.
All right, Creel, take the woman into the trees. Morton and I'll watch these two.
Mr. Morton's been taking me.
It don't matter who takes you. Just go and get your business done.
Come on, miss.
Kara seemed to have gotten used to the lack of privacy and didn't let it bother her anymore. She went into the brush and hoisted her skirts without argument.
Has Mr. Morton ever been married?
Why in the world would you want to know that?
I'm just curious, that's all. He seems like such a nice man. I figure some woman must have hooked him at one time or another.
Well, you'd be wrong there. He's never been married. Never even come close, far as I know. Although he's talked about it a few times when he met some widow woman he particularly liked. Why you want to know about Scratch? Seems like I remember you trying to cut him open with a razor not that long ago.
Kara came out of the bushes, straightening her clothes as best she could since the shackles still kept her from being able to move her arms very well.
I'm sorry about that. I didn't know him then, and I was just loco to get away. I can't stand to be cooped up anywhere.
You seem to be standing that wagon pretty well these days.
What choice do I have?
She didn't say anything else about Scratch. Bo took her back to the camp and escorted Lo and Elam into the woods in turn. The prisoners ate supper and turned in for the night, stretching out on the floor of the wagon and wrapping themselves in blankets against the chilly night air. Bo and Brubaker headed for their bedrolls as well. Scratch stood the first watch. He sat on a log near the fire, his Winchester across his knees, and let his senses reach out into the night, alert for anything that was out of the ordinary. He never looked into the flames for more than a second at a time, knowing that to do so would weaken his night vision. He knew he needed to stay as vigilant as possible. Time passed slowly, as it usually did when he was standing guard. Scratch was a naturally gregarious sort. He loved talking to people and just having folks around him. He had company tonight, of course, but they were all asleep. He was glad it was cold. The chill probably helped keep him awake. The little hiss came from the wagon. One of the prisoners was trying to get his attention. Maybe supper hadn't agreed with whichever one it was, and he or she needed to visit the bushes again. In that case, he would have to wake up Bo and Brubaker, and the deputy would likely be pretty annoyed. He stood up and went over to the wagon. He put his mouth close to the tiny crack around the door.
What do you want?
Mr. Morton? Scratch? Is that you?
Yeah, it's me. You need something?
Just some company, I guess. I'm having trouble sleeping.
I can't let you out of there.
I know you can't, but maybe you can talk to me for a little while until I get to feeling like I could doze off.
All right. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. I just needed to hear the sound of another human voice. You ever get like that, Scratch? Just so blasted lonely that you think you're gonna shrivel up inside and die?
Well, not hardly. Bo's always around to talk to.
You're lucky. Growing up, I never had any real friends.
You must have had family.
Yeah, some family. Trying to make a living out of a hardscrabble farm in the piney woods down in East Texas. All my ma and pa cared about was how much work they could get out of me. And after I wasn't a kid anymore, all my brothers cared about was what else they could get out of me, if you know what I mean.
I'm sorry. Must have been a pretty hard life. But that's no excuse to go to robbing and killing.
I never killed nobody. I know they say I have, but that's all lies. There's nobody who can say they ever saw me kill anybody, because I haven't. It was Hank and the other fellas in the gang who did all the killing.
You were there for some of it.
Well, what else could I do? What happened is, Hank came along a few years ago when I met up with him, and all I could think about was how if I went away with him, I'd get away from that damn farm once and for all. And so when he asked me to, I did. It didn't seem like I had any choice.
We always got choices.
Yeah, but I didn't know that then. I didn't know what Hank was really like, either. I didn't know he was an outlaw until I was part of the gang. And then it was too late. I had to go along with whatever he said. He can be really nice when he wants to. But he can be really mean when he wants to be that way, too. I had to keep him happy with me, or else he would have turned me over to the rest of the men. Or worse, just left me somewhere to shift for myself.
If all this is true, I'm sorry for you, miss. You'll have a chance to tell your side of it at the trial.
Do you think anybody will ever believe me?
Well, considering how you came after me with that razor and how you acted since we left Fort Smith...
I haven't done anything except yell, son. And you'd yell, too, if you thought you were going to be dancing at the end of a hang rope for things you didn't do. And as for the razor... Like I told your friend, Mr. Creel, I was just about out of my head. I can't stand being locked up. I was loco to get away. I'm sorry for what I done, Scratch. Really and truly sorry. And I'm glad now that I didn't hurt you.
You and me both. You better try to get some sleep now.
All right. Thanks for talking to me, Scratch. It eased my troubled mind a little.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
You probably thought I was going to ask you to let me go, didn't you?
It wouldn't have done you any good.
I know that. That's why I didn't waste my time. You're not the sort of man who'd turn on his friends for a woman.
No, I sure ain't.
But what about a woman who knows where there's a fortune in greenbacks and gold?
What are you talking about?
When me and Hank and the rest of the boys were running wild down in Texas before we ever came up here to Indian Territory... We had a hideout in some rugged country west of Fort Worth. There's not much out in those parts except rocks and rattlesnakes. So Hank figured it was safe to stash most of our loot there. We kept what money we needed to get by and cashed the rest in a cave.
And you're saying that money's still there?
Don't forget the gold. Yeah, it's still there unless somebody found it. Nobody would know to look for it there, so it'd have to be somebody just stumbling over it, just blind luck. I'll bet anything it's still there. I bet my life on that, Scratch.
Yeah, well, but I don't see how that has anything to do with what's going on now.
I know how to find that cash. I could lead you right to it. There's plenty there to make two people rich.
No, forget it. Bo and me gave our word to 42 and to Judge Parker. Anyway, Bo'd never go along with it.
I wasn't talking about Bo. Or does he do all the thinking for both of you?
That ain't the way it is. We're partners. Equal partners.
Sure.
What about Lo and Elam? You know, we couldn't take them.
The hell with them. I don't owe them a damn thing. Brubaker and your friend can take them on to Tyler and the Hangman, as far as I'm concerned. I promise you, considering some of the things I've seen them do, whatever happens to them, they got it coming.
Bo would come after us.
You think so?
I know he would. He tried to track us down sure as shooting. It'd be better to wait until after we cross the Red River, and then it won't take us as long to reach that hideout. See, we'd have a better chance of getting away with it.
I suppose I could wait a few more days. Even though being locked up like this is making me awful crazy, Scratch.
Oh, you can do it. It won't be much longer, and then the two of us can be together.
That sounds good. I'm so glad I didn't cut your throat, Scratch.
You and me both.
The next few days were uneventful, which came as a definite relief after the journey's action-packed beginning. Brubaker kept the wagon rolling from dawn until nearly dark, changing trails several times, but always trending in a general south-to-southwest direction. They passed a number of farms and skirted around a couple of settlements. Hank Gentry might have spies just about anywhere, Brubaker explained, and he didn't want to make it easier for the outlaws to find them. That made sense to Bo. They were out of the Cherokee Reservation now, and were crossing Choctaw land, Brubaker told them.
You really do know every foot of this country, don't you, 42?
Damn straight I do. I've been riding for Judge Parker for several years now. A man who don't know where he's going winds up dead more often than not.
Words to live by.
How about Texas? You know your way around down there?
Why in the hell would I know my way around Texas? I can find my way around from one place to another, but it's out of my jurisdiction. No offense to you Lone Star waities, but I agree with General Sheridan. If I owned hell in Texas, I'd live in hell and rent out Texas.
I reckon there are plenty of people who feel that way.
But we make allowances for them because they don't know no better.
They reached the Red River, the boundary between Indian Territory and Texas, the next day. The stream, with its banks of reddish clay that gave the water its namesake color, twisted through rugged hills. Brubaker explained that as the trail sloped down toward a low water crossing, it went between a couple of high-cut banks covered with stunted brush. Bo was riding in front of the wagon. When he was still a few hundred yards from the river, he held up his hand to signal a stop and turned in the saddle to talk to Brubaker.
I don't much like the looks of this. This is a good spot for another ambush. How many crossings like this are there along the river?
Half a dozen or so. Depends on how far west you go, I guess. You think Gentry's waiting for us down there?
He's bound to have figured out by now that we left the main road back in Arkansas. He might have tried to follow us. Or he might have decided to get ahead of us instead and wait for us to come to him.
That ain't very likely, considering that he wouldn't have any way of knowing which crossing we'd head to. His gang's not big enough he could set up an ambush at every place we cross into Texas.
Maybe not, but he could send men out to watch every crossing and get back on our trail that way.
Would Gentry risk crossing back over into Texas just to rescue these three? Didn't he light out for the Indian nations to start with because the law made it too hot for him south of the Red River?
It's true that he and his bunch got out of Texas by the skin of their teeth when the Rangers were after him. But that's been a couple years ago. Yeah, I think he'd risk it. Gentry sets a lot of store by that girl in there. And Lo and Elam rode with him for a long time. He has to get them all back or he'd risk losing the respect of the rest of the gang.
Well, why don't you wait here while Scratch and I take a look around? We'll scout out the crossing and come right back.
Oh, sure. Just be careful in case there is some sort of trouble waiting up there.
We're always careful. Sometimes what we do just looks reckless.
Come on.
While Brubaker sat there with the wagon, the Texans rode on toward the river. Scratch was thinking as he rode. He figured that what Brubaker had said about Gentry's gang getting out of Texas one step ahead of a posse of Rangers was the answer to one of the things he'd been wondering about. That had left that loot stashed in the cave Kara had told him about, because they'd never had a chance to go back and get it. When they rode away from the hideout for the last time, they hadn't known that they wouldn't be able to return.
See anything?
Not so far. You really think Gentry posted watchers at all the river crossings in these parts?
Possible. It may not even be regular members of his gang, just wild youngsters who want to be outlaws, like Jink and Mort Staley and their cousin Bob. If I was Gentry, I think I'd be waiting with the rest of my men at some central location, so that if one of the watchers saw us cross the river into Texas, he could gallop there and carry the word. Then Gentry and the gang could get on our trail.
Well, that's some devious thinking there, Bo. I think we missed our calling. We should have been outlaws.
Yeah, maybe so. But I sort of like being able to sleep at night.
They rode along the eastern bank, overlooking the trail, and didn't find anything unusual. Then they doubled back and started checking out the western bank. As they approached the edge that overlooked the river, Bo suddenly reined in and lifted his head to sniff the air. Tobacco smoke. Somebody was in the vicinity, all right, puffing on a coral leaf. Whoever it was might be totally innocent, with no connection to Hank Gentry, but they couldn't risk that.
Well, I don't see anybody up here. Might as well go on back to the wagon, tell Deputy Brubaker that it's all right to cross the river.
While he was talking, Bo swung down from the saddle and handed his reins to Scratch. The silver-haired Texan frowned in concern, but Bo made a reassuring motion with his left hand and drew his gun with his right. Scratch turned his mount and rode back toward the wagon, leading Bo's horse. To anyone listening, it would sound like they were both returning to the wagon. Gun in hand, Bo stole forward stealthily. He approached the edge of the bank where it dropped off rather sharply to the river, some 20 feet below. The smell of smoke was stronger now. It drifted up from a brush-choked ledge that ran along the northern riverbank, following the curve of the bank and gradually descending to a flat area next to the water where some scrubby trees grew. Bo studied those trees closely, and after a few moments, he caught a glimpse of movement there. He continued watching until he was able to make out a horse cropping at the sparse grass under the trees. Someone had picketed the animal there, and that somebody had to be hiding in the brush farther up the ledge, watching the crossing. And foolishly smoking a cigarette, too. That was the only thing that had given away the man's presence. Bo moved closer to the edge of the bank and peered down into the brush. He thought he might be able to spot smoke rising from the corralie, but the smell was fading now. The watcher had finished his smoke, and he didn't seem to be in a hurry to build another. He couldn't keep completely still, though, which told Bo that he was probably young. Most experienced frontiersmen had the ability to remain motionless when they had to. A lot of times, being able to do so was a matter of life and death. In this case, the watcher shifted, and Bo spotted the movement. Now that he knew where to look, he was able to pick out the shape of a brown hat among the mostly bare branches. The watcher wore a brown coat, too, which helped him to blend in with the gray branches and the reddish-brown dirt. Sunlight reflected off something beside him, the breech of a rifle, Bo decided. He could have gunned the man down without much trouble, but that would be cold-blooded murder. Not only that, but Bo couldn't be absolutely certain the watcher was working for Hank Gentry, although that was the only explanation that really made sense. If the man was a member of Gentry's gang, or even if he just wanted to be, he might possess information that would be valuable. The ledge was about 12 feet below Bo. He holstered his gun, then rose to his feet and gathered himself. He knew that Scratch and Brubaker were probably watching him, and as soon as he made his move, Scratch would too, so he would have help if anything went wrong. The watcher shifted again. He leaped over the edge of the bank and plunged straight down at the hidden man. As soon as he caught his balance, Bo came up on one knee and drew his Colt.
Oh, holy cow! I think you busted all my ribs!
The watcher's hat had flown off when Bo knocked him to the ground, revealing him to be young, probably no more than 20 years old. He had a thick shock of rumpled red hair that went with his freckled features. The rifle that lay on the edge, close to the spot where he had been hunkering on his heels, was an old single-shot weapon. As far as Bo could see, the youngster wasn't carrying a handgun.
Don't try anything. I don't want to shoot you, but I will if I have to.
Oh, didn't you hear me? I'm busted all to pieces inside.
I doubt that. I didn't hit you that hard. What's your name?
Early. Early Nesmith.
Why were you lurking in these bushes, Early? Waiting for somebody to come along so you could bushwhack them and rob them?
No! I wasn't lurking. Can't a fella stop to have a smoke without somebody jumping him?
You didn't just stop to have a smoke. You were hidden in this brush and you've been here a while. I see what's left of a half dozen quarrelies lying there.
I don't have to talk to you. You got no right to ask me a bunch of questions.
Well, I reckon this Colt in my hand gives me the right to ask whatever I want.
All right. I was waiting for somebody. A friend. He's supposed to meet me here, but he ain't come along yet.
All right. I guess I'll just have to shoot you. That way you can't go running to Hank Gentry to tell him what you saw. But when he gets curious and sends somebody to check on you, and they find your body, he'll figure this must be where we crossed. By then, though, you'll be dead, so it'll be too late for the knowledge to do you any good.
You'd really shoot me in cold blood? But you're supposed to be lawman.
Bo smiled at the young man.
I said too much, didn't I? Now you really are gonna kill me.
No, I'm not. Or at least I might not, as long as you keep telling me the truth. Are you part of Hank Gentry's gang?
I ain't never rode with him on a job, if that's what you mean. Me and some other fellas just sort of hung around wherever Hank was, hoping that someday he'd take us with him when he went to rob a bank or hold up a train or something.
Where was this?
Oh, I ain't saying. I don't turn on my friends that easy. You can just go ahead and shoot me if you want.
Hank Gentry and those owl hoots aren't your friends, son. If you're lucky and live long enough, you might figure that out one of these days.
What are you gonna do with me?
Yeah, Bo.
Scratch spoke from the top of the bank, where he'd come up without Early noticing him, although Bo had.
What are we gonna do with him? He's too small a fish. He ain't a keeper.
You better go ahead and kill me. If you don't, I'll hunt you down and shoot you both.
Settle down. This isn't some dime novel. Ranting and making threats isn't gonna do you any good. Can you get to your feet?
I don't know.
Why don't you try?
My ribs
aren't broken, or you wouldn't be able to breathe and talk the way you are.
Well, by God, they feel broken.
Up.
Early struggled to his feet.
There. You satisfied?
That'll do for a start. You're here alone, aren't you?
Well, that's right. Hank trusted me to handle his job by myself. He knows I'm a good man.
Scratch, go tell 42 that he can bring the wagon on across. We'll collect Early's horse and meet you at the ford.
You're not gonna shoot him?
Not yet, anyway.
42 ain't gonna like having another prisoner to take care of.
Well, if Early gets to be too much trouble, I'm sure there are buzzards and coyotes on the other side of the river, too. Now, you get moving. Down the ledge and around the bend to where you left your horse.
You're gonna be mighty sorry about this. Hank don't take kindly to hombres who mistreat his friends.
I told you, you're not Hank Gentry's friend. A man like that doesn't have any real friends. Only people that he uses to get what he wants. Where are you from, anyway? Seems like I hear some Texas in your voice.
A little town called Tioga. It ain't too far from here.
I've heard of it. What made you decide to cross the Red River and become an outlaw?
That's none of your damn business! You ever pick cotton, mister?
I sure have.
Well, my daddy works a cotton patch on shares, and he expects all of us kids to work, too. I just couldn't see spending the rest of my life bent over picking those damn bowls. So as soon as I got big enough, I lit out.
Just because you don't want to be a cotton farmer doesn't mean you have to become an outlaw.
Maybe not, but seemed like the quickest way to get rich.
That's all you want to do, get rich?
Don't you?
Can't say that it's ever interested me all that much. Having a bunch of money seemed like more trouble than it was worth. You have to be worrying all the time. Something might happen to it.
Not having money doesn't worry you?
Not all that much. I'm not so old I can't do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay.
What are you going to do when you're too old to do that? How are you going to take care of yourself then?
That question brought a frown to Bo's face. It was something he had thought about from time to time. He didn't have any close relatives who would take him in, and as far as he knew, neither did Scratch. There had been some lonely nights on the trail when they got to talking and wondering about such things, and neither of the Texans had an answer for the problem. On the other hand, the sort of lives they led, the way trouble followed them around, it was more likely they'd get shot or knifed before they got so old they couldn't fend for themselves. There was a lot to be said for dying with your boots on. Early's horse was a placid-looking chestnut gelding. Bo untied the animal and swung up into the saddle.
Hey! Are you stealing my horse?
Nope. Just riding back down to the crossing on it.
How am I supposed to get there?
Well, you can wade along the edge.
Why'd I have to wade while you get to ride?
Well, for one thing, I'm older than you. You should respect your elders. For another, I've already been wading one time this week, and I don't have any hankering to do it again. Now move.
The crossing was only 100 yards or so from where Early had left his horse. He slogged through the reddish mud and shallow water at the edge of the river, and Bo rode behind him, covering him with the colt. By the time they reached the crossing, Scratch and Brubaker were waiting for them, just on the Texas side of the river. They all went up the trail between the cut banks to the flats at the top. Bo dismounted.
Climb on top of the wagon.
What do you got in mind to do with that boy, Creel?
I don't want to put him in with those three prisoners. But I don't want to have to shoot him off his horse if he decides to let it shuck either. So I figured we could tie his hands and feet and he could ride on top.
I'll fall off!
We'll try not to. That sounds like a pretty good idea to me, Bo.
Why are we even taking him along anyway?
Well, 42, you're the boss, so if you don't want to bring him, I reckon we can just tie him up and leave him here. Somebody might come along to turn him loose before he starves to death. I just thought if we took him with us, he might be able to tell us some more about Gentry and the rest of that bunch.
I told you, you're wasting your time. I ain't a double-crosser.
Also, we'd have him to use as a hostage if we needed to.
Now you really are loco. If Hank Gentry wants to kill you, he won't let me stand in the way. Why, he'd just shoot you right between
That's your right. He'd just shoot you to get to us because he doesn't care whether you live or die, Early. Are you starting to understand now what I've been trying to tell you?
All right, you convinced me, Creel. Get up there, kid. Morton, you got some rope I can use?
I sure do.
A few minutes later, Early Nesbitt was sitting on top of the wagon with his hands tied together behind his back and his legs stretched out in front of him with the ankles roped together. As long as he made an effort to stay balanced, he wouldn't be likely to fall off. Bo tied the youngster's horse to the back of the wagon alongside Brubaker's saddle mount.
Ready to go?
Let's get moving then. Right now, the more distance we put between us and Indian territory, the better as far as I'm concerned.